Hello and welcome to Cromford's Assortment on Thursday, the 9th of April 2020. On this day, the 9th of April, in 1413, Henry V was crowned King of England. He had his hair cut around a soup plate, and if you've seen Olivier in the film, you'll know what I mean. On this day, in 1784, King George III of England ratified the Treaty of Paris, officially ending the American War of Independence. Woo-hoo! On this day in 1959, the eminent American architect Frank Lloyd Wright died. So long, Frank Lloyd Wright. Somebody should make a song around that. On that very same day in 1959, NASA announced the names of its 7 Project Mercury astronauts. And if you can name them all without Googling on your little bit of scrolly palm porn, 10 extra points for you. On this day in 1966, actress Sophia Loren married producer Carlo Ponti. It was a great day for the Welsh. On this day in 1969, the first British-made Concorde made its maiden flight. Pilot Brian Trubshaw flew it from Filton to RAF Fairford. Both of those places are in Gloucestershire, so I'm guessing that he didn't take the old bird up to Mach 2 for that one. He'd have overshot, wouldn't he? On this day in 1932, Carl Perkins was born. And no, I never stepped on his blue suede shoes. On this day in 1806, Isambard Kingdom Brunel was born. And no, I never stepped on his big top hat. And on this day in 1898, Paul Robeson was born. And no, I never swam in his old man river. And finally, and this one's priceless, I love this one, April the 9th is Unicorn Day. So, all those of us who occasionally get up and go to the mirror and find that there's a great big bristly eyebrow sticking out right in the middle of the bridge of their nose, today is for you and I. I'd like to become a bit more serious now and say a bit about the current crisis and the various restrictions and clampdowns we're all facing. In these circumstances, I think it's more important than ever that we cling to the dreams that we have and... On that theme, I'd like now to introduce another piece of live busking that I performed in my studio last Monday. It's a song with a message relevant to what I was just waffling on about. Here's a song. Audrey Hepburn sang this in the film Breakfast at Tiffany's. Jerry Butler had the American hit with it. Andy Williams recorded it and it became closely identified with him. Danny Williams, no relation, had the British hit with it. And I used to sing it to my nan when I was 2 years old, and she would always fill up, bless her. It's a lyric by Johnny Mercer with music by Henry Mancini. It is, of course, Moon River.
Old dream. same rainbow's end. It's waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend.
Well, that was quite nice. Now, if you were listening to the longer version of last week's programme, the premium version, you'll know that Marriott Frinton, the origami master, had started to show us how you can make your own hazmat suit out of two pieces of 8-foot square, shiny-sided washi paper. Now, here he is again to continue.
So, here's what we'd made by the end of last week's session. You remember, we'd made the basic flapping bird folds, but we pulled this flap, flap A, out again, and made a rabbit ear fold under the fipple. Yeah? Okay, what we need to do now is shug that fipple, just a touch, like so. Because we're going to do a taffy front on it later. Otherwise, of course, the pantaloons won't have anywhere to hang from. Now, you see what I'm doing here? I'm using my thumbnail to make a hard crease right the way up the fuse. We're being very, very careful not to extend it into the placket. Because the zip's got to go in later, and if the placket gets biased, well, the zip won't seal, your suit's up the swanny, and you'll be in all sorts of jelly. Done all that? Right, now it's time to do something about flap A. And now you realise why we're using shiny-sided origami paper. I want you to take flap A like this, the way I'm holding it now, and I want you to recursively pleat it like so. Don't worry, this washi paper is surprisingly springy. It won't tear while you're doing this, but it will get quite taut as you keep pleating, and you need to be careful not to... Ah! Yes, you see, that's what could happen if you don't hold it really firmly. Of course, I was distracted by talking at the same time. That wouldn't normally happen. Anyway, when you've got 16 of these pleats, and they are feisty little beggars, aren't they? When you've got them firmly under your fingers, you need to pull the shoked fipple over them, all the way over, and then let go. See? Yeah, I know it looks a bit rude, popping erect like that, but don't worry about it. You've just made your first taffy friend, and we can see about making some twig frond pantaloons that will slip easily over that shiny shugging.
Oh, but that's for next week. I just need to go and bathe this.
It's time for On the Trot, where I dig out an old piece of music from the back of beyond that's suitable for people to move their limbs to if they go out for their daily exercise. This one's a bit more leisurely than last week's. It could either be a leisurely jog or a very energetic walk, depending on what you prefer. It's a Rod Clements song from the first Lindisfarne album in 1970. It's Road to Kingdom Come.
Walking down the
previously in a boo at bedtime. Robert C. Hogg was a sparse, shy little man who ambled through life with lowered... He lived at the very top of the house, in a miserable two-roomed flat with sagging ceilings. One night in early January, when the moon illuminated the 30 or so feet of lawn, I walked two-thirds of the way up the garden, and then turned and cast a cursory... With my head turned to the far right, my left eye had an oblique view of the furthermost tree. I could see a dark shape that might have been that of a woman dressed in black and wearing a long head shawl. An inch either side... Robert C. Hogg made his first tenuous approach the following evening. He said quietly, "My lights have gone out." I collected fuse wire, a pair of pliers, a screwdriver, and, as an afterthought, a strip light on the top landing enabled me to see the open door of his flat, but I was completely unprepared for the unpleasant smell. It had a sweetish, cloying quality that can only be associated with a rotting corpse. "But how can you stand the cold? It's enough to freeze the what's-its off the proverbial." "Cold preserves, but there is still the corruption of the soul." A really vindictive woman has much in common with a hungry tiger. She will stalk you to perdition, and no amount of penance will placate her. A Vindictive Woman by R. Chetwynd Hayes. Part 3. "Have you seen her?" I spoke slowly while watching him through narrowed eyes. "Last night I thought I saw someone under the trees." "And that was it. He got up, his face a mask of pure terror, and all but ran for the door, and left me as near dumbfounded as at any time in my life. But he must have slowed down on reaching the hall, for I heard him creeping up the second flight of stairs, as though reluctant to reach the top landing. No power in this world or the next could stop me going into the bedroom and drawing back the curtains. The lighted shadow window was back, laid out like an illuminated picture across the grass, with the silhouette of my recent guest passing to and fro, but it was the almost imperceptible shape that stood just beyond the lighted square that clothed doubt in the cold raiment of reality. Now there was no need to adjust the angle of vision, for I could dimly see a slim figure that wore some kind of long evening dress and probably a black lace head shawl. I might even have caught a brief glimpse of a pale blur of a face, although this was uncertain. The thought slipped unbidden into my brain. "Oh my God, she's moved nearer." Just before Hogg turned out his light and complete darkness erased both shadow window and whatever did or did not stand beyond. Some minutes later, I made what was probably the most shrewd observation of my life. The coldness is fear. The stench is death. An entire week passed before I saw Robert C. Hogg again. I was seated at my desk in the sitting room, having developed a distaste for looking out over the back garden, when I saw the little man climbing the front steps, his hat pulled well down over his ears and gripping the handrail with grim determination. At the same time, I was aware that someone else was just behind him and well over to the left, allowing me to catch a glimpse of a head that wore a black lace shawl. I had the ridiculous feeling that if that unseen person were to move 1 or 2 inches to the right, I would probably lose my sanity. Then I heard Hogg insert his key into the Yale lock. The door crashed back against the wall, and this was closely followed by him running along the hall. And I do mean running. A terrifying, foot-stamping, ceiling-shaking gallop that continued up two flights of stairs and was finally terminated by the distant slam of a door. Presently, I went upstairs and found the front door open. Having closed it, I ascended to the first floor landing, now an expanse of shadow-haunted gloom. I peered up at the one above, toying with the unworthy intention of mounting the third flight and possibly pressing my ear against a closed door. But this piece of nefarious behaviour never came to fruition, for scarcely had I put foot to the first step when the merest suggestion of a black shape looking down over the banisters sent me racing back to my own domain. It would seem that whoever pursued Robert C. Hogg was now in the house, but not yet in his flat. She was up there, on the top landing, waiting. Mr. Hogg paid his second and last visit the following night. The tapping on my hall door was timid but insistent, and finally I had to draw the bolts and open up. As he entered and walked silently to the fireside chair, I shrank back. Face as white as snow in moonlight, head well forward, he stared into the fire, his limbs twitching in a most frightful manner. At that moment, I hated him, alive to a fearsome possibility that something I did not want to see might come through the closed door after him. I shouted, shook clenched fists, and even considered the idea of grabbing his scrawny neck and marching him out of the front door. "For God's sake, go! I can't help you! No one can! We all walk in our own hells!" His face was a mask of frozen terror, and although his mouth opened and closed, it seemed as if speech was beyond him. I knew he was trying to tell me something that he considered to be of extreme importance, but, God help me, I didn't want to know. I could only decide that he must be very ill, and that the right place for him was a hospital. So I turned my back on those bulging eyes and constantly writhing mouth, and grabbed the telephone receiver. I was irrationally irritated by the number of questions that I had to answer before being informed that an ambulance would be there in the quickest possible time. When I again looked at him, his eyes were still watching me, his mouth gaping, one hand outstretched, but now there was no movement of any kind. I thought, he's dead. Only he didn't really look dead, just paralysed by fright. To remain in the same room as that thing was an impossibility, so I wandered around the flat, even occasionally opening the front door, vainly hoping to hear the approaching sound of a siren that would inform me that the dreadful wait was over. Then, possibly to delay having to return to the sitting room, I strayed into the bedroom and, without thinking of what I was doing, walked over to the window. There was no moon, and the rectangular slab of light lay across the lawn, the shadow-edged squares, one might almost say, the ghost of that fearful window. And, oh God, a shadow figure was passing back and forth, a shape that wore a shawl on its graceful head. And then it suddenly stopped, and another shadow joined it. And I'd recognise that head anywhere. Damn you, I could even make out the receding hair, the thin face. But I must have been mad, for wasn't he seated in the next room? And that woman, the bloody vindictive woman, was hitting him with something, and it might have been a poker, and I could actually see his mouth opening and closing, screaming, screaming. Only the screams were coming from my sitting room. Then the light went out, And so did I, and mercifully I knew no more until the ambulance men kicked my door in. They had to break Robert C. Hogg's arms and legs, for apparently he was frozen stiff, and that was the only way his corpse could be put into the zip-fastened stretcher bag. Later, the police asked a lot of questions. How long had he lived in the house? Did he have any visitors? And so on. I did not tell them about the woman who finally caught up with him. He was traced back to a nice little house situated on the outskirts of Swindon. In it was discovered the body of his young wife, attired in a black evening dress with a lace shawl draped about her lovely, if a trifle dented, head. She was in an excellent state of preservation, as he had folded her more or less neatly before stowing her in the freezer. All of which is, I suppose, as good a reason as any for a woman to become vindictive. That's about all I've been able to cobble together for you this week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and if so, please make a date for the next week's Thursday, the 16th of April. Meantime, keep a grip on yourself, be patient, stay sane, safe and well. I made this program for you, and I'm going to be here sending them out as long as you're there to receive them. Let's get through this. Bye for now. Cromford's Assortment was conceived, assembled and presented by me, Paul Cromford. I don't own the songs Moon River and Road to Kingdom Come, I just borrowed them to entertain you. A Vindictive Woman was written by R. Chetwynd Hayes, edited for broadcast by Paul Cromford. Spooky ambiences during a boop at bedtime, courtesy of DSK Virtual Synthesizers, Carol Morden Todd, ESN Productions and Paul Cromford. All other incidental music in the program, yada yada yada, yours truly. This was a Paul Cromford production for you.